what is a social structure and a cultural assumption if not individual behavior?
What is it actually about? Is it about the way I criticize, the way people criticize, or is it that enough people can get together to socially push for a change in behavior, often towards conformity?
By the time you get a degree in some academic discipline, you should be able to tell good work from bad work. Philosophers can't.
Any term that is not absolutely true is meaningless. Philosophers. All right, David, what are we still talking about this week?
Welcome to part three, which you made me assure you we wouldn't call part three, but it's too late.
No, that's fine.
So welcome to Postmodernism Part 3, Critical Theory, in which critical theory is probably going to be the only thing we talk about, so it's not really postmodernism, but that's okay.
Well, yeah, and I think we could... I mean, let's just do the episode real quick. So if you look at the Wikipedia article on critical theory, I think there's one sentence at the very top that explains this perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
Not to be confused with critical thinking, philosophers. So someone... Someone came in here with real spicy.
Salt detected. Wow, I didn't even notice that up there. That's funny.
Pretty great. I'm going to make sure to snipping tool that. So next time someone tells me I need to start thinking using critical theory, I'm going to be like, sorry, I'm more into critical thinking.
More of a critical thinker myself. Well, okay, let's talk about critical theory. So critical theory is a term I hadn't really heard until we started looking into postmodernism as such, but I'd heard of like subcategories of critical theory.
Like, I think the one everybody hears about these days is make a big kerfuffle is the critical race theory.
Yes. So we'll get there.
Okay.
Okay, so from the Wikipedia article, I think this does a decent job of telling us where we're going. So a critical theory is any approach to social philosophy that focuses on society and culture to attempt to reveal, critique, and challenge power structures. With roots in sociology and literary criticism, it argues that social problems stem more from social structures and cultural assumptions than from individuals. It argues that ideology is a principal obstacle to human liberation. Critical theory finds applications in various fields of study, including psychoanalysis, sociology, history, communication theory, philosophy, and feminist theory. Specifically, critical theory, capitalized, is a school of thought practiced by the Frankfurt School theoreticians, names inserted here. Although a product of modernism, although many of the progenitors of critical theory were skeptical of postmodernism, critical theory is one of the major components of both modern and postmodern thought and is widely applied in the humanities and social sciences today.
So it's applied widely in the not real sciences today.
Yes.
Cool.
See our episode on social or hard versus soft sciences.
Yep.
To hear our feelings about that. Okay. So I think the core thing here is arguing that social problems are a consequence of social structures and cultural assumptions rather than like individuals' behavior.
Okay. I think it depends on what you mean, right? Like that, like just looking at this wholesale, there are a couple of things in here that I'm like, I do kind of see where they're coming from, and I actually may kind of agree, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, the one word that hung up was in the first sentence for me, which is a critical theory is any approach to social philosophy that focuses on society and culture to attempt to reveal, critique, and challenge power structures. And that's its own article.
What is a power structure?
And yeah. I just opened that up. So let's talk about that. So remember, this is a social philosophy. Okay. So a power structure in political sociology, but also operative within the rest of the animal kingdom. A power structure is a hierarchy of competence or aggression, parentheses, might, predicated on influence between an individual and other entities in a group. So.
Literally a structure of power. Okay.
But it also is literally not what was being talked about in critical theory.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're calling it like it is. Because if I were to take that definition and plug it in, essentially, it would be A critical theory is any approach to social philosophy that focuses on society and culture to attempt to reveal, critique, and challenge a hierarchy of competence or aggression predicated on the influence between an individual and other entities in a group. So if you're critiquing that system, what are you critiquing if not the individual being mentioned here?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not about a system. And I think power structure is a lot more honest, even though honestly the definition is very strange, to say this is political sociology, but also operative within the rest of the animal kingdom. What does that even mean? Like, those are very different, unless you were talking about other animals, like social.
I think that is what it means. I think it means that, yeah, other animals do have a concept of hierarchies.
Not all of them.
No, not all of them, but some.
Sure. So I guess fine, but the...
Interesting that they felt the need to put that there.
In that way, like, why not just say other...
But I guess it's because, creatures. Yeah, they're trying to make that into a very generic article about what is a power structure at all, sure. And not what is a power structure as it relates to human society.
Fair enough. But I think the power structure article is a lot more succinct and poignant on what a power structure is, but I think the definition is being kind of warped a bit when you discuss it in terms of critical theory, at least maybe by the proponents of critical theory out there in the world today. Like, if I had to categorize what critical theory is, and if I had to give someone, like, here's how to know if you've even heard of a critical theory before, because usually people won't say, here's my critical theory for how this is. Like, they don't say that.
Mm-hmm.
You'll kind of hear it when people say things like, it's not about people, it's the system. Like, this is a system of inequalities, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's not about... Like critical race theory being one of the most common iterations or types of these critical theories. It's not about individuals being racist. It's about the system being racist, right? Mm-hmm. That's usually the critique given. But if you actually look up what that system they're talking about is, that system that they're substituting is the power structure, is what they're talking about.
Right.
But if you go and look at what the power structure is, it's the individual at the top of that power structure. So if you were to unravel all of the weaseling definitions, when someone says, it's not about all these other individuals who are racist, it's just about the guy or gal at the top being racist, essentially. Even though that's not what they mean, that's what they're saying according to the terminology, right?
Well, does it necessarily mean the one at the top, or just these many individuals who are in some way above others in a power structure?
That's fair. It could be that... But at the same time, if you're analyzing
one thing that is coming to mind would be like, okay, let's pick a certain class of people who are considered to be powerful, corporate executives.
Okay.
So like corporate executives do not act as a unit.
No.
But you can criticize them as a class, kind of, because there are things they have in common. And you could say that they are all part of power structures because each of those individual executives are part of a power structure, are part of different power structures within their company. And we could go lower than that and say, okay, if we want to keep the business metaphor, even lower level managers also are part of a power structure, right? The manager has authority over his employees.
Maybe. Well, and maybe I'm getting hung up on that word, individual, because let me read the next sentence under power structure. Mm-hmm. A power structure focuses on the way power and authority is related between people within groups, such as government, nation, institution, organization, or society. Such structures are of interest to various fields, including sociology, government, economics, yes, and business. So
yeah, it's the structure in which these individuals exist, not just the guy at the top.
Okay, so...
The use of the word individual there is kind of weird.
It is, because if you use it again in that sentence, it's a hierarchy of competence or aggression predicated, which means
relying upon
influence between an individual, one person, uh-huh. and the other others in a group.
Right. Well, so yes. So let's take the lower level manager, right? That individual has power over the group under him.
Yes.
So, but there are many such individuals in a company.
That's true. But if you're analyzing the power structure appropriately,
and those lower level managers, given the adjective lower, indicates there's higher upper managers above them that are also part of the structure.
Sure, I understand that, but you're always pinching it from the context of the down to an individual. It's one way or the other, right? Because you could say also, if you're analyzing it from a lower level perspective, take an individual, like just take any random individual, and you can analyze the power structure around them in a web. They have their boss who's above them. They may have a parent that's above them, a teacher who's above them. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't matter how you do it, but you have to pick a point and then move outward, right? And I guess my disconnect is, if you're doing power structure analysis, I'm fine if we can discuss power structure analysis about group v. group, or a classification v. other classification and how they're structured. Mm-hmm. That's fine. And that's what I thought people were talking about. But that's not what this seems to indicate, which is what's confusing. Because if this is true, but the other is also true, then you cannot analyze any system. Like, to say...
Well, what is a system if it's not made of its parts?
That's true. But again, we're not analyzing the system holistically. We're picking it from a specific individual as the nexus point of that group, right? And if the criticism you're having is that this structure is racist... For example.
Sure.
Okay. Either what you're saying is the individual is not racist, it's the connection between them and all the other members in the group, or inversely, the individual being the one in the position of power, this is usually the critique, is racist, but that's not as goal forwarding as what I think is usually attempted when we are trying to apply critical theory, and maybe there's an additional piece of context that I haven't even brought up yet, which is oftentimes the point of this critique is to create a society that is less the thing the critical theory is about. So critical race theory, by its name, has an objective of critiquing society on that axis. Mm-hmm. How can we make society less racist?
Right.
Right. Okay. That's the stated goal. You can't have it both ways. You can't say, you can say you want it both ways, but I don't think, but they're not the same approach. To say that the system is racist would imply that there is something about the way the system is configured that makes it so. Or there's an individual in a position of power in that system that is the problem. And I feel like this has been this is my kind of big complaint with critical theories in general, is which is it? And this, I think, is usually where you see the arguments forming, where, you know, like to Ben Shapiro, for example, is an outspoken, you know, dissenter of this theory, because he will often say things like, show me the racist and I will agree that we should deplatform them or whatever.
Yes.
Right. So he is emphasizing that individual aspect. Those who are proposing the critical whatever theory would say, no, it's not, we can't go find you the racist. Although they do exist, but that's not what we care about. It's the system.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, what about it then? Is it the fact that there is a hierarchy, or what? Like, what else is it? You know, is there a policy, you know? And I think for the sake of my sanity, if we're going to talk about critical theory, I would like to know, which is it? Like, what are you actually looking at? Or is it the relationship between the individual and the role that they hold, or the role that that individual holds and the other roles in the hierarchy?
That's generally how I think about it. Yeah.
So it's not about
the position. Yeah.
Okay. So it's not about the police chief whose name is Jared. It's not about Jared. It's about police chief.
The office
chief.
Of police chief. Yeah.
Okay. So that's not an individual, but still, I get that's at least a position.
I guess maybe the reason that they went for it individual in their definition is also the same reason they felt the need to point out other parts of the animal kingdom, because other animals that aren't humans don't have offices. They don't have these abstract concepts of whoever holds this position. No, it's just, you know, this one is higher in the hierarchy. This individual is higher in the hierarchy because animal social reasons for whatever that species is.
Alpha male, alpha female.
Sure, whatever. Yeah, if it works that like stuff. That for that animal, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. I know that may have sounded like a bunch of...
there's
not
an office of alpha male, right? Like, there's just the one...
that occupies that role.
Right. And that for that group.
For that group. And that pattern emerges. Okay.
Yeah.
And I know that may have sounded like a bunch of semantics, but it's important because that's
also welcome to the show, because that's what we do.
Well, it is part of what we do, but also, hear me out, that's what most of critical theory is. Mm-hmm. Semantics.
Yes.
It's the same thing that we've always heard about, just semantically rebranded to something more marketable in the modern era, as is most things in postmodernism. Change my mind. It's still modernism with different terms, but we're going to take the terms and make them what we want them to mean. Anyway, that was the last two episodes, so I don't want to go back.
Yes.
Okay, so that all aside, now that we've dealt with that,
Getting
past the first sentence now, you know, a good
15 minutes later.
Sentence two. No.
This is normally sentence two is what I normally think about when it comes to this, is the assertion that social problems come from social structures and cultural assumptions rather than from individual behavior. Well, what is a social structure and a cultural assumption if not individual behavior?
Yeah.
And it's just like the aggregate sum of individual behavior.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think I actually had an interesting conversation about this morning. So my mother and I were having brunch this morning because I'm a proper lad and, you know, but, we were discussing how, you know, we happened to see someone walking by that we both had the opinion was dressed inappropriately. Okay.
Okay.
Now, as a good, you know, agorist pragmatist, I don't really care, but is it my preference? No. Does my preference dictate what others should be able to do? No.
No, but you can judge them.
I can. And that's where our conversation started, you know, because I was asking her, I was like, so what do you think about that? And she was like, well, I mean, I wouldn't even look at the person. I wouldn't do anything. I would just say, do you, or whatever. And I was like, okay, that makes sense. But at the same time, what is wrong with me looking at the person and going and like scrunching my face up? Like I disapprove. Like,
right.
I should be allowed to voice my disapproval.
You should even be allowed to walk up to that person and tell them how you feel about it. It might be considered rude depending on how you decide to handle that, but
sure.
Should be allowed.
Yes. And they should be allowed to tell me to, you know, buzz off about it. Right. Go pack a lunch. And it's like, okay, you know, but this is literally...
So, right, so long as it doesn't turn into harassment, right? That's where it crosses the line. Yeah.
Exactly. Which is if I started to follow the person and be like, boo, you know, like, until you change, I'm going to keep doing this. And so to critique, not that second thing, but to critique the first thing is to say, again, I think my issue with postmodernism is, okay, fine. We also then shouldn't celebrate things. Because that's also social influence of a power structure. Because there are carrots and there are sticks.
Mm-hmm.
So if sticks are not okay, what if I carroted the person who dressed appropriately? Is that okay? Like, what is the actual problem? Is it the criticism? Is your criticism my criticism? Or is it that it's negative criticism? Or is it the thing that I'm being critical about?
I think, well, okay, I mean, I guess that's kind of an interesting question, but also I don't know if it applies. Like, is people judging other people's choice in wardrobe a social problem?
It can be. Good example. Cultural appropriation is one of the things that has come about through a critical lens.
Mm-hmm.
That is literally what that is. People, it's a bunch of individuals who look at something and say, I don't like that. therefore forming an aggregation or a power, leveraging the dynamics of a group to push influence. You shouldn't do that, right? And that is literally just about what someone wears a lot of the time. It can take many forms, but like one of the forms in which it manifests is what you're wearing, your dress. For example, I could go put on a feathered cap and moccasins. Now, I am not an Indian. I have no Indian in me. So I would look very strange. But there would be people who would take up issue with that.
Right.
So what is it actually about? Is it about the way I criticize, the way people criticize? Or is it that enough people can get together to socially push for a change in behavior, often towards conformity? Because that's the default behavior of humans and most social creatures. Conformity. You know, we all need to fit a common expectation, and we don't directly, I think, cooperatively work to create that expectation. In like, we're not actively trying to create that expectation. It is just something that exists, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen this happen with time. Tattoos are a good example. The cultural attitude about tattoos has shifted over time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, while there may have been people out there advocating that tattoos shouldn't matter when it comes to your like place of work, the vast majority, I think, of that change was just that they became more common, and they became so common that they're no longer outside the norm. Therefore, they're acceptable.
People don't think that you're icky because you have a tattoo. Yeah.
Right. They're no longer,
because they've seen enough other people who are otherwise not icky who have tattoos. Yeah.
Right. There's not enough concentrated tattooed people that are degenerates. And that's not my opinion. That's just, I think, how the person who would be critical.
Right. That was the cultural assumption at the time. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, only criminals have tattoos or something like that.
Right.
Or degenerates. But now that, I know plenty, but people in the subsequent generation is like, well, I grew up and knew many people that had tattoos that were not degenerates. So I didn't form that stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's more culturally acceptable. So the way that stereotype ended up being, vanishing was just through cultural osmosis of people getting tattoos and then becoming popular because people like that type of body art, and that's fine, right? And the same would happen with dress. To go back to my personal anecdote, why did I even find that to be bothersome to me? Well, I grew up in a very Christian informed environment,
mm-hmm.
where there were plenty of standards around, informal standards around dress, which included the upturning of noses towards people who didn't fit that standard and a stereotype about them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm aware of that. That doesn't change the way I feel about it. Although it may change the way I rationalize it. And that's also maybe the reason why I'm not going to say anything about it. Because guess what? It's not that...
It's actually none of your business.
It's A, actually none of my business. And B, even if the person does fit the stereotype, why do I care about that? Which I don't. The issue is it's not so much that I've become accepting of people who dress a certain way. It's that I've became more accepting of people who actually live the life that I began to associate with people who dress that way. Thus also rendering the people dressing that way as something that I don't care as much about. But I still personally don't like it. My biases have built up over time enough to be one and such as which that I don't like it. So I don't exercise on it. But that doesn't mean that when I see it, it doesn't make me feel negative, right? I think that's pretty straightforward. But I guess back to the question at hand, if someone was looking at this through a critical lens, what's the actual core root of the problem? Is it me? Is it that I even noticed the difference? Is it that I even thought the thing that I thought? And this is what I'm trying to drill down to and understand about critical theory. What actually is the issue? Like, what's the core problem, I guess?
I don't know.
I don't either. And I'd be willing to bet money that most of the people who actually use this theory, much like other bits of postmodernism, the root actually is they don't like that I didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
Because who doesn't like, or who likes not being liked? You know what I mean? And so... if your criticism is nothing beyond that, then we're back to where we started. The battle of preferences. The aggregation of the preferences is going to be one that enforces the degree to which that dynamic influences an individual, you know? And that's not to say that that, and I think that what we both can agree, and both schools would agree, even though, again, this is not new to critical theory, is a question about whether, what we should do about it, right? You know? I think there's an interesting, and then maybe this will yield a better answer. So I you skipped over the names, and you also skipped over a quote by one of the names.
Yes, I did.
I'm also not going to read the names, but I'm going to read a quote to describe, so one of the people described a theory as critical insofar as it seeks to, quote, liberate human beings from the circumstances that enslaved them. So it's the circle. This is like, you know, this weirdly reminds me of, this reminds me of egoism.
Yeah. You know what? Okay. I see where you're coming from now, where, yeah. Like, okay. So all of the cultural assumptions and social structures are spooks.
Yeah. That's exactly it. Yeah. And, but all this is saying is that people should be free of these things, whereas egoism directly tells the individual who wants to be free of these things to break free of them.
Right. You can be free. Just stop believing in these nonsense concepts.
Yeah. You've been
trained by society to believe in, but don't actually exist. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is kind of weird.
That is weird. Well,
it's the other side though, right?
Yes.
It's not you need to stop believing in it. It's that people should stop professing the belief that you should have stopped believing in, right? So, like, for example, if I have, like, my Christian values are a spook, like, for me, right? That I grew up with. So, Stirner, an egoist, would say, just give it up. It's a spook. You know it's a spook. Forget about it. Do whatever you want to do. What do you really want to do? And then go figure out how that's also a spook, and then get rid of that, and then figure out what you really want to do, you know? I feel like this person that Horkheimer, this is the name of the person who was quoted,
sure,
would probably say, no, you don't need to forget about it. You need to attack that belief. You need to get rid of the belief itself from existence. You need to wipe it off so that it can't enslave others.
Right. Expose it as a spook to
everyone, and then abolish it. Because the thing about it is that you cannot help but be enslaved to these things, right? That's the assumption.
So when you notice this happening, you should challenge it, yeah.
Yeah, challenge it and overturn it so that it can't enslave anyone else ever again.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, in Stirner's egoism, spooks are ideas.
Right, but this also includes,
the institutions who forward
power structures.
The ideas.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which are, power structures are a bit less spookish than...
They're a bit more concrete. Yes. Yes. And to go back to this, I went back to the power structures article to quote, power structures can be formally organized, such as a military or a church. Conversely, a power structure may be an informal set of roles, such as those found in a dominance hierarchy. In which members of a social group interact, often aggressively, to create a ranking system. So...
Like in high school.
Yes. Abolish high school.
Abolish high school, actually.
Not a bad idea.
Half joking, yeah.
So I think now we're getting somewhere. I think we're cooking now. So, how? Because that's another thing you'll notice. This doesn't give you the manual for how to do that.
No.
Like most good activist handbooks, it doesn't actually recommend you do anything. You have to fill that part in, you know, which is kind of an interesting thing and arguably dangerous.
Yeah.
Because any philosophy that proposes a course of action, but does not dictate the rules of, or dictate the pathways of those actions, kind of includes all of them as acceptable paths. So, arguably, a communist uprising revolution, technically, would fulfill could be a acceptable natural outcome of someone exercising critical theory. You know, we're going to take the existing power structure that trods upon the proletariat and we're going to shoot it. And by it, I mean the bourgeoisie, you know, like,
right.
And that technically is totally fine within critical theory. Now, granted, I'm not trying, critical theory is not a person. It's also not a necessarily a, it's not a set of rules and a protocol. It's just a way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
But ways of thinking can inform ways of acting.
That's usually the reason people think about anything, yeah.
And that's also why we care about beliefs on this show, in a nutshell. What you believe changes how you behave.
Yes.
So maybe that's one of my biggest critiques about it, is that you're setting forth an idea about what people should believe. And I'm not going to say that these people, because I don't necessarily think that it's true, are advocating for a way to behave. Although I would argue that, and I would argue that because of the nature of the subject, like, we've done an episode of Authority v. Power, right?
Yes, a long time ago.
But still a good episode. So the people who are discussing this theory do understand that dynamic and difference, arguably, since they're talking about it, or I would hope so if it's a well-thought-out theory.
I wouldn't necessarily make that assumption, but go on.
Those who came up with the theory, you know, academically, I would hope. If you're going to reference a subject, you should probably understand the whole subject to at least some degree. And if you're calling up power structures, the second sentence, a power structure focuses on the way power and authority, are related maybe.
Grammatical error.
I need to edit this Wikipedia article.
live Wikipedia editing on philosophers.
Right. So I would suppose then that they would understand that the attempts to do this would be via both of those things. And if you are a subject and enslaved by the institution, then, and you, that would suggest to me that you do not have the authority to change it. Maybe that's not always true. Because I could see someone who advocates for critical theory advocating for, like, get out and vote for thing.
Mm-hmm.
For change, right? But they are also tacitly acknowledging that push comes to shove, you know? And I think that's one of my biggest problems with this, is that it's this is an ideology that has baked into it a way to enforce itself on others to spread, or to spread the impact. And I think that's my biggest critique of this, is critical theory offers no solutions and only offers a way to see problems.
Right, it's a lens.
Yes. And any system that only operates as a lens but doesn't offer... Have we ever brought up Anti-Citizen X before?
Yes.
Have we ever talked about his thoughts about the direction of philosophy and what makes it crap these days?
No.
I think that's an important point I'd like to make. If you can remember, so, in summary.
Longtime listeners of the show will remember our friend, Anti-Citizen X, who's not actually our friend because we've never talked to the guy, but we really appreciate his work.
We really do.
And yes, one of his more recent videos was about academic philosophy today and why it is a complete disaster and a joke among academia. So you should go watch that.
Well, what's his thesis, essentially?
Well, academic philosophy doesn't really know what philosophy even is, and more importantly, doesn't know how to tell good philosophy from bad philosophy. You would think in any academic discipline, you should be able, like, by the time you get a degree in some academic discipline, you should be able to tell good work from bad work.
Yes.
Philosophers can't.
Yes.
They cannot, because they have not come up with an objective way to measure the quality of a philosophy.
Right. And I feel like one of the things that he mentions in there is that there is no consideration to the practical effect of a philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I would even argue, and I'm not trying to put words in his mouth here, I will take it one step further and claim any philosophy that does not offer solutions to problems that it proposes is a bad philosophy. Or a way of thinking about a problem that might yield a solution. And I'm going to point back to, like, say what you will about egoism, but I do like that in that philosophy, it suggests ways to deal with the problem. Now, it's not demanding it, necessarily.
No. I mean, yeah, it seems, yeah, to me that egoism is mostly about, like, by the way, most of the things that inform your behavior are stuff that other people made up, and if that's getting in your way, you should ignore it and do what you want.
Right. Even more bigger umbrella philosophies have this, you know. Of course, as soon as I go to say, of course, I forget the name of it. not pragmatism, the other one where you can essentially do math on everything to solve the problem. Five people sick, so you need to take a body part from one person who's healthy.
Utilitarianism?
Yes. That is a philosophy that suggests a way to look at something, but also suggests how someone who thinks this way would reason how to deal with problems. Now, it doesn't say specifically how to measure happiness or success, but what it does say is that you should create a way to calculate the greatest, you know, utilitarian
right, yeah,
value.
Yeah. You need to come up with a utility function, right? Yes. A function that tells you the utility of all the possible outcomes of a thing. And then the moral decision is whichever one results in the highest utility.
Right. And then it stops short of becoming a science by not suggesting how to make a utility function specifically for a given instance. It just says that one should exist.
Measuring utility is tricky. Yeah, it's kind of subjective. Yeah.
Yeah. So with critical theory so far, there's still more we could scroll and read, but I am assuming that's where I'm going to have my problem. So far has just said, here's how you examine a problem. And the only, I guess, suggestion here is that structures shouldn't exist because all structures are bad. So do not structures.
Certainly, yeah. If critical theory is supposed to, if any critical theory is supposed to be about challenging power structures, then yes, it would seem that the end goal is that there should be no power structures.
Right.
But that may not necessarily be true, again, because there are specific subcategories of critical theory. So, you know, let's take, for example, without reading any specific thing about critical race theory, if we just assume what critical race theory might be based on what we've looked at so far, then critical race theory would be about challenging any power structures that are based on race. But other power structures may be okay under that lens.
Based on?
Or revolving around.
What do you mean, though? Like, what if I just draw a conclusion through the lens of race? For example, police brutality.
Mm-hmm.
That's a problem.
Yes.
But a critical race theorist does not care about just police brutality.
Right. They care about who the police are being brutal against.
Yes. And while there may be nothing in police policy that says
Beat
people of X race up on site.
Mm-hmm.
What they instead do is use statistics to figure out if there is an imbalance, and then from that lens suggest a problem. And since you're baking into your lens, you got to look for the structure. Well, if the structure you've zeroed in on is police and law enforcement, then of course the problem has to be with law enforcement, because that's pre-dictated by the critical part of critical race theory. So the race part is, we're going to take statistics based on race. And then the critical part is, we're going to look at this at the police power structure. Is there an imbalance? Yes. Is there a power structure? Yes. Ergo, conclusion, this power structure leads to this imbalance. Ergo de facto, you know. So it's kind of just presupposing that the power structure is the problem and you need to fix it. Like, it's the source of the problem, not the people in the power structure necessarily, but the power structure itself is the problem. So if we make police go away, we won't have police brutality, which arguably is correct. That is true.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have police brutality, racial or otherwise, if there are no police.
Right. Yeah, there just won't be.
There just won't be. Now, is that a nuanced, deep take?
No.
No, not at all, yeah, actually. Yeah,
because that's literally the take of have that removed immediately. Like, as soon as something has a problem with it, just get rid of it.
Right. And to be fair to critical theorists, very few people will say abolish the police. Now, some do. But most are a little bit more practical than that and would suggest some way around it by mm-hmm. changing it. But I think the issue that I have here is that the whole point of what makes police police in this case, just like the whole point that makes any structure institution remotely effective, and by effective I mean just have an effect, good or bad, is the fact that it concentrates power or authority, usually both. If it doesn't do that, then it can have no effect, and in that case is rendered useless. So how can you change a power structure such that it doesn't have an effect but also still serves a purpose?
Right.
You can't. Mm-hmm. That's the whole point. That's like, to use an analogy, saying, I don't want any voltage differences, but I am looking to have power. And that may not be a metaphor that translates for most people, but I think you get the point.
Mm-hmm.
There is an interesting section in here on postmodern critical social theory.
I did look at that section, yes.
Should we drill in here, do you think?
I don't know that we need to spend very much time here.
Okay.
I did find one interesting snippet.
Okay.
Postmodern critical theory politicizes social problems by situating them in historical and cultural context to implicate themselves in the process of collecting and analyzing data and to relativize their findings. I don't know what any of that means.
Sounds made up.
The next sentence, though, is what made me cross my eyes. Meaning itself is seen as unstable due to social structures' rapid transformation. As a result, research focuses on local manifestations rather than broad generalizations. What?
I actually think I get this one. I get what they're trying to say.
Okay.
I think. So I'm going to use an example to kind of paint this. It's all about scope. Okay. So, for example, globally, for all humankind, I could say, what is a man? But different cultures may have different nuanced specifics as to what the meaning of what a man is meaningless at that level. Okay. So let's zoom in. What is an American man? Well, that's also meaningless because there's a bunch of different ones. Okay. So that's meaningless. Let's zoom in again. What is until you get to a point where it's not a generalization anymore, it is true. The problem is that for certain things, you have to go all the way to the individual level for it to become totally true all of the time.
Okay. That's fair.
So the critiquing would be any term that is not absolutely true is meaningless because generalizations are meaningless. Or not meaningless, but they're not effective. Maybe they do mean meaningless. Or it's unstable, so we shouldn't use it for social structures. Which, again, okay. Well, I hate to say this, but we don't write a code of laws for every single human being that exists.
Yeah.
Because there's also a practical side of this, which I think is also obviously missing from almost all of this. Practicality is irrelevant.
Right, no one's actually suggesting that we act that way. Yeah.
Well, the theory suggests otherwise, but again, this theory, critical theory, has... I could probably control F this entire thing for the word practical, and it probably not appear. Or if it does...
Watch me do that. It doesn't.
Okay, there you go. So, ergo, nothing about this has to be practical, because that's not the point.
Mm-hmm.
It's about right and wrong. Like most philosophies, it is setting out a moral judgment of good or bad. However, the axis of that is almost entirely aligned with whether or not a power structure exists and how practical. And I think that kind of defeats the purpose of, you know, why power structures exist, not because they came out of the vacuum for no reason. most of them existed to serve a purpose. Be that a good or a bad purpose, I'm not saying.
Sure.
They do exist. They did not. It's not like all humans were 100% equal and didn't care at all. I mean, there were no power structures. And then one person's like, I have a good idea. I'm going to invent the power structure and then use it to enslave other people.
Right. Yeah. No one woke up one day and chose slavery. Like,
well, some people may have, but like, well. And I think that, like, as cringe as I think that it is, I mean, this is where, like, the lobsters comes from, that meme. I think,
oh, related to our favorite frog.
Our favorite frog. It's to suggest that it's not academic. It is a fact of nature. It's a phenomena in nature that occurs, even in lobsters, to suggest that this is not a human problem. And if we're focusing strictly on society, well, lobsters don't really have a social structure, really.
Mm-hmm.
But or they may have the most bare minimum one you could possibly have, and it has a power structure. So I think the argument, even though he's not good at making it clearly without doing his own word games, is that you cannot have society without power structures in some way, shape, or form. It's like to say that you cannot have politics with one person.
Right. Yeah.
You know. There isn't... The next, I think, bullet point, I do think is very, very interesting. Pedagogy.
Yes.
This is, actually, I think, one of the most interesting and places where I actually tend to agree as far as a measure of importance. For those of you who don't know, pedagogy, I'm going to read the sentence. Critical theorists have widely credited Paulo Freire, spelling, for the first applications of critical theory to education / pedagogy, considering his best known work to be Pedagogy of the Oppressed, a seminal text in what is now known as the philosophy and social movement of critical pedagogy, dedicated to the oppressed, and based on his own experiences helping Brazilian adults learn to read and write. Freire includes a detailed Marxist class analysis in his exploration of the relationship between the colonizer and the colonized. In the book, he calls traditional pedagogy the banking model of education because it treats the student as an empty vessel to be filled with knowledge. He argues that pedagogy should instead treat the learner as the co-creator of knowledge. And I'm not going to read the rest of this. Pedagogy is a fancy word for education or learning.
Yes.
Essentially what it is.
It's like the study of learning and education. Yeah.
Yes. And what I think he's hitting, I do agree with the point. I agree with the general idea he's trying to address that education is a very powerful vessel mm-hmm. through which ideology can go to people.
Mm-hmm.
And he's 100% correct there.
Yes.
So much so that I think it is no surprise why that is often one of the battlegrounds you'll see when different philosophies are competing in the wild in the social
space. What should
we
be teaching the kids? Yeah.
Because what you teach the kids and what they learn is how society will be.
Yes.
Next. And he's 100% right. I totally agree.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a very good question. It's also a question about which there are a lot of opinionated answers.
Mm-hmm.
What should we teach kids? Who's to say?
Well, yeah, that is the big question. Who's to say? Yeah.
Yeah. Who gets to say what we teach to which kid?
Right. There do appear to be right and wrong answers to, like, generally what types of things should we teach kids, but when it comes down to the specifics, yeah, it's ultimately just somebody's opinion as to what's most important to tell them about,
because there is non-infinite but practically infinite knowledge to teach them, but a very finite period of time to formally educate children. And that's usually where the conversation comes about, because we have outsourced education to institutions.
Right.
And I think that's also a part of his criticism, is that the fact that that I think is more poignantly his criticism, is that anytime you have an institution of education, it creates an imbalance in the learning experience in which one person is at a disadvantage to the other and essentially forced to learn what the teacher has to say.
Right.
And his model would suggest that it should be the way you destroy that power structure is you get rid of the institution of learning and have someone with knowledge, someone without knowledge, but they kind of learn it together, which doesn't make any sense because one of them already has the knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of a ludicrous suggestion, but I think he also isn't saying that necessarily. What he's saying is that in his particular case, without having read it, I'm going to assume that, I skimmed a bit, so I guess I am looking into it a little bit. One of the ways that especially because he mentioned colonizers, one of the ways that we saw colonial powers extend their influence throughout the colonial era was the formation of religious schools. Mm-hmm. Because, and this happened a lot, right? Christian names, like that was a thing that came about. The idea being that we can't deal with these, quote, I'm quoting them, savages, these non-civilized people.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to even begin to deal with them, we must civilize them first.
Which means, how do we do that? Teach them our religion.
Yeah. Teach them our religion, which may or may not also directly enforce our philosophy on structures in the first place.
Right, and how we're going to treat them going forward. Yeah.
Hence, you know, especially since most of these colonial powers were monarchies, if they believe the religion, then they'll believe in the god of that religion, and they'll have to understand that God chose me to be in charge, and they need to listen to me.
Even though I'm across an ocean. Yeah.
Yeah, because God said so. And he's over there. He's watching you. In the panopticon of God, he's watching always, you know?
Mm-hmm. I think this guy's main idea is not that the teacher and student learn it together, because obviously the teacher can't learn it again. But treating the student with respect as an intelligent being who can also come up with novel ideas even as they're learning from the teacher. Like, instead of the teacher be like, I am the arbiter of knowledge, I teach you everything that is true, and you just listen to me and do your work, you know, acknowledging that the student is going to come up with ideas and you should take them seriously as they do.
Yeah, the only issue with that is the line that says, he argues that pedagogy should instead treat the learner as the co-creator of knowledge.
Yeah, that is kind of a weird phrasing. So I'm also reading the next sentence. I'll skip to the second half. But a participant who... Okay, actually, no, I do need to read the whole sentence. In contrast to the banking model, the teacher in the critical theory model is not the dispenser of all knowledge, but a participant who learns with and from the students in conversation with them, even as they learn from the teacher.
Sure, but what is the point in learning something you already know?
Well, they're not. The idea here is that the students may indeed come up with new ideas on their own as they learn from the teacher, even ideas that the teacher doesn't know. The teacher is obviously going to be the subject matter expert going into the thing, but students can ask questions that the teacher may never have thought of before.
Okay, that's more fair. And also, if I think about this from a tutoring perspective, as in there is a teacher, period, mm-hmm. that teaches all the things, then I think that's much more practical. And I think if you look at the way industrial education is now, which is more subject matter based as opposed to, like, it's all about the download of knowledge about a particular subject, and also making sure everyone has the same understanding about the subject, which is useful for a cohesive society. There's no place for that there. And I think that is a good critique too, because I think there is a good criticism to go back to, like, why is it that the rulers and the people who were able to do things and make decisions back in the day, how was it that, like, people will often say, how is it that Benjamin Franklin was doing statecraft, but also writing poems, but also painting, but also tying keys to kites and getting electrocuted and studying bifocal? Like, how were these people seemingly all Renaissance people? Like, you had two classes of people, the mm-hmm. Renaissance people who ran everything, and then surf, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
How was that? Well, it's because most people back then were tutor taught, or they were just taught. It wasn't, oh, you need to know about math, science, and this, you're good enough to get into society, get out and go. Like, and we never took that learning model and applied it to everybody. Instead, because it's inefficient and hard. And if you're tutoring, you usually have one tutor with a few students, and that tutor is able to focus in on those few students and do this process, right? Where they're posing questions and trying to get the student to think critically about critical thinking about the problem. Because a lot of solutions, especially in things like the like mathematical philosophy, are all derivation, or largely derivation. And once you understand the core principle, you should actually be able to follow the same logic and come up with all the things that other people came up with yourself in some shape or form. You may call things different things, whatever, but you should be able to come up with it yourself. It all should connect in a way that is fairly intuitive, such that, because it's based on reality, right? Our common understanding of reality, you should be able to do that. But instead, it's like, well, we don't actually need the peasants to know all of this, and we don't really, it's hard to teach them all to be critical thinkers in that way. But it's much, much easier to say, here are the words. Here's what they mean. Here's how you string them into a sentence properly. Here are numbers. This is how they're used. Here are the operations you can do on numbers that you're going to need to do most of the time. Don't care about how they came about. The theory about it is not important. Here's the practical knowledge. You know, that I think he does make a good argument there. And I do see your point more in that way, is that education should be an experience in which, and maybe if I'm looking at this from the word, like the co-creator of knowledge, what he maybe means here is not the objective knowledge about a fact. It's that student's knowledge. The student is involved in gaining that knowledge for themselves and owning it in such a way. And then to that, I would totally agree. I think that is a much more quality learning experience. And if it falls in line with everything else we've discussed so far about critical theory, it's just impractical on large scale. That's the main issue with it, is how terribly inefficient it is at our current level of capability. Because I don't think anybody would argue that, hey, what if we just magicked in a bunch of money and made it to where every student had their own teacher, their own tutor.
Right, that's just going to be objectively better, yeah.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Everyone's going to be way more educated. And arguably, this would have been achievable if we made the role, I think, of parents as educators more important.
Right, because there are enough parents to do that. There's two of them for every, well, not for every child, because parents can have more than one child, but still.
But yeah, but it's a lot, the ratio is a lot better than...
The ratio is a lot better than what we have now, where we have like one teacher in a room of 20 to 30 kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, in that way, I do think that's a good, I think, application of it. But again, it's not suggesting... It's suggesting an ideal outcome, but I don't think you need to attack the power structure necessarily, unless by that the assessment that you get from the power structure is not that the power structure is bad, because at the end of the day, one person still holds the truth as they know it to start with, and is trying to guide the other person. Instead of just telling them what it is, you're trying to guide them to it so they can kind of co-own it. But being responsive to perhaps adjustments. But I would argue that, I am also critical of education systems. Like, for example, if a teacher has a book that has a literal wrong fact in it and they teach it and a student says, that's actually not correct, this is what's correct. The attitude of most teachers would be, shut up, I'm the teacher, you listen to me, you don't know. Instead of saying, prove it, and then if the student demonstrates proof for it, accepting it, and then teaching that, I don't see that actually happening in most industrial education. So yeah, I actually am okay with this.
Yeah.
I'm a big enough man to accept that I don't like most critical theory, but that one I'm more okay with.
Because
there actually is a very good practical application of it at that level, you know.
It's basically going after the power structure of the expert. Essentially, yeah. It's looking at a certain particular instance of experts and non-experts, which is the teacher and student relationship, but that continues into adulthood.
Which I think, if you're curious about our opinion on experts,
we have an episode called Experts
where we talk about that.
Yes.
It's a very critical episode about
experts.
Arguably.
It is critical that you listen to it after this.
I'm going to go back and listen to the episode now and see if we actually accidentally exercise critical theory on experts in that episode.
Okay. That'd be interesting.
Yeah. Especially given my particular, I remember criticism of a certain expert who I was very critical of.
Oh, yes. I remember now.
Yeah. Neil deGrasse Moron. But anyway. Sorry.
So we're coming up on time.
Yeah.
We did not really get into critical race theory as such. We talked a little bit about what it could mean in context of what we were reading generally. I don't think that the extrapolation that I made is actually representative of what people mean by critical race theory.
Probably not. It might either.
So maybe we should visit that at some point. I don't know that I want to do that next week.
I really don't either. I'm sick of it.
I'm kind of tired of this topic. But yeah, maybe eventually we can revisit that. I think it is probably an important one to look into. I don't think now is the time.
No, but I think just to foreshadow maybe a bit, and I think this is kind of how I feel about most critical theory in general, because let's think about the practical application of this, right? Most people who are listening to this probably aren't critical theorists, probably. I would argue that most people aren't. They just take what a critical theorist might say and say it very uncritically. But if you're in your travels, you were to come across somebody who's talking about it, I think the best way to deal with it is to remember that this is just a lens, ultimately. There's nothing wrong. Well, and I think that the key point here is to, like I say, there's nothing wrong with looking at the world through a lens, but to suggest it's the only lens is the problem. And that's where I would probably start, because I think most people's issue with the lens is that people will take that lens, highlight a problem, and then before you can even begin to address the problem, they jump straight to the solution because of the lens they're in. Mm-hmm. And it provides a level of obfuscation to the problem itself, making most conversations around that problem non-productive or unproductive. And so if you do find yourself maybe in a debate with somebody where you both seem like you're talking about something and you're trying to argue that there is a problem, but the problem, the root problem is not what they think it is, it's something else, debating about their solutions to the non-problem is not a productive use of time. And so I would say that, like, and this is what I would say, you know, if I was debating somebody and they were looking at something through a critical lens, just remember that this is purely philosophical. It has no practical impact on anything. It's just a way of looking at something and a way of thinking about it, which is the nice thing. And the horrible thing about philosophy is no philosopher will ever call wrong, because it is like a cardinal sin of philosophy to say the philosophy is wrong.
Right.
Only the conclusions of my philosophy can be wrong, not the philosophy itself, which again, I think strikes at the core of...
Well, and conclusions can only be wrong within the framework of some philosophy.
Yes. And if my philosophy is the everything is right philosophy, then it literally can never be wrong, but is also a trash philosophy.
Right. Is objectively useless.
Right. So I would say that probably one of the best ways to deal with this, if you don't believe it, is to just back up and attack the philosophy directly. And don't attack it in the context and terms being used. Attack it directly for what it is. Like, say, okay, like, I would even say, like, if I was having a debate with somebody on it, I would say, well, let's not even talk about that problem. Let's talk about something else. And because usually I feel like philosophies are employed as a way to sound smart about a particular issue that you actually care about. You know, most people will say, I don't like police brutality. But instead of looking into police brutality, they look for a philosophy that provides a bunch of fancy words around why it's wrong without looking at the actual problem.
Instead of talking about why it's wrong for the police to beat people up. Yeah.
Yeah. And instead look to justify it elsewise. And because that's a lot easier.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Let's tell a story about this being a racial issue or something like that. And it's like, okay, but there's actually a bigger problem here.
Which I think when you combine with postmodernism, where you can just define any word to be evil, you can just make anybody who doesn't believe your thing evil. And now you've cornered someone into saying, well, here's my theory. Well, I don't believe your theory. Oh, then you must be evil, a racist, a sexist, a bigot, you know. And guess what? Within the confines of these non-mutually exclusive philosophies, even though they're kind of like should be mutually exclusive, They can't be wrong. And so you have to attack the philosophy itself. You have to move away from the issue, which unfortunately also sounds like someone who's trying to straw man away or not care about the problem. Mm-hmm. So it's a good thing. Stepping back and looking at this from a conversational gamesmanship perspective, it's a great tactic, but it also has setup. You have to position the pieces to get there. And the best strategy for dealing with any long game that requires a lot of setup is to attack it before the setup is set from a gamesmanship perspective, which again is usually the sign that you're not even in a realm for productive conversation anyway. So unless you're just there to joust socially, and then don't waste your time if you're not, because you're not going to have a productive conversation anyway. So yeah, at me. So next week, not postmodernism.
We're not doing postmodernism next week.
All right, you heard it here first. Philosophers.
Philosophers.
If you like the music in this episode, please check out Jippy on Bandcamp at jippy.bandcamp.com.
Philosophers is supported by viewers like you.
If there's a topic you'd like us to discuss,
or a topic you'd like to see revisited in the future,
please let us know by contacting us using the methods in the description,
or in the comments below. Thank you for listening.